They Katra podcast conversations for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome, curious learner. Let's start with a quick thought experiment.
Okay, I'm ready.
If I see the word Rastafari, what's the, you know, the first image that comes to mind?
Oh, for most people, I'd bet it's Bob Marley.
Exactly. Bob Marley, the dreadlocks, the colors, that powerful global aesthetic.
And that image, as powerful as it is really the heart of the problem we're getting into today.
How so?
Well, the global success of reggae has, in a way, reduced Rastafari to just those stereotypes. It's become a commodified lifestyle.
And that strips away its foundational sophistication, both politically and theologically.
Precisely.
So that's our mission today. We want to move beyond that caricature. We're doing a deep dive into Dr. Ennis B. Edmonds' amazing study, Rastafari, Theology, Culture, and Global Resistance.
And this book really forces you to see Rastafari for what it is. It's not some spontaneous trend. It's one of the most significant, coherent theological systems of the modern era.
A system forged in the fire of historical trauma.
Yes, a complete counter-worldview to Eurocentrism and colonialism. And why this matters so much today is because it's this incredible lesson in how marginalized people can create identity and hope.
When the dominant system tells them they have none.
It's a universal story of resilience.
Let's talk about the author, Dr. Ennis Barrington Edmonds. He's a professor of religious studies at Kenyon College.
Right, specializing in Caribbean religions.
We see a lot of academic work on these kinds of movements, but what makes his analysis so authoritative?
Well, it's his unique vantage point. This isn't just an academic parachuting into a field.
Okay.
He was born and raised in Jamaica. And not just any time during the 1970s and 80s.
Wow. So right when Rastafari was exploding from a marginal movement into a global force.
Exactly. He saw it. He experienced the social impact firsthand.
So his work bridges that gap between rigorous scholarship and authentic cultural sensitivity.
It does. He treats Rastafari with the seriousness you'd give to any major world religion. But he also has this deep respect for its spiritual significance to believers. It gives us the whole picture.
Okay, so let's unpack the book's central argument. Edmonds is very clear. This is a complex, dynamic tradition. It's systematic.
Not random at all. He argues it's a deliberate, you know, systematic effort by displaced African people to reclaim their identity.
To recenter their own history and decenter the Eurocentric worldview that had. Well, that had justified their subjugation for centuries.
Right. But this idea didn't just spring from nothing. There was an intellectual foundation.
And that's where we have to talk about Pan-Africanism, and specifically Marcus Garvey.
Garvey is the crucial roadmap here. His message was all about Black pride, self-reliance.
The Universal Negro Improvement Association.
Yes. And most importantly, he made that famous, almost prophetic statement. Look to Africa when a Black king shall be crowned, for the day of deliverance is at hand.
So Garvey provides the political fuel, but there was another current, right, an older one.
Ethiopianism. This is a pre-existing spiritual movement that looked to Ethiopia as this beacon of Black sovereignty.
Because it was a Christian nation in Africa that had successfully resisted European colonization.
Exactly. Yeah. So what Rastafari did was synthesize these two powerful ideas. Garvey's political prophecy, and Ethiopianism's spiritual hope.
And the book just lays this all out so clearly. It traces the whole life cycle from these roots through the big event in 1930, its worldview, its practices.
All the way to its global spread and the new challenges that brought.
Okay, let's get into the genesis of the movement, because the context is so important. We need to set the scene. 1930s Jamaica. What was the tinderbox like?
It was a scene of just intense despair. I mean, you have the toxic aftermath of slavery still hanging in the air.
A colonial system still in place.
Mass poverty in the cities, pervasive racial humiliation. People were desperately looking for a story that could explain their suffering and, you know, offer some kind of hope.
And then came the spark. The huge pivotal event in November 1930.
The coronation of Rastafari Makonnen as Emperor Haile Selassie II of Ethiopia. This was a global news event.
And early preachers in Jamaica, people like Leonard P. Howell, saw this happen.
They seized on it. For them, it wasn't just politics. This was the fulfillment of biblical prophecy. The Lion of Judah, the Black Messiah, had appeared.
So if I'm understanding this right, this was a radical reinterpretation of Christianity. They took the sacred text that their oppressors had used against them and
they flipped the entire narrative.
Oh.
And this brings us right to the core of their theology. The central belief is in Jah God, who is imminent, who dwells inside every person.
And Haile Selassie I is seen as the living physical manifestation of that divine force.
The returned Christ, yes.
Edmonds calls this the ultimate act of theological rebellion. Why that phrase, ultimate?
Because it directly repudiates the white European image of Christ. You know, the one that had been used for centuries to enforce a racial hierarchy.
So by deifying an African monarch,
they affirmed the inherent divinity of the black body itself. It was the highest form of spiritual and political self-love you could imagine.
Which sets the stage for their whole worldview, which is built around this conflict between Babylon and Zion.
Right, and Babylon, for Rastas, is more than a place. It's the whole corrupt, oppressive Western system.
Mm-hmm.
Capitalism, colonialism, injustice. It's a spiritual state of being.
The consequence of a wicked system. And Zion.
Zion is Africa, especially Ethiopia. It symbolizes liberation, divine order, a spiritual and physical home. This framework is so important because it gives them a coherent way to name their oppressors and to resist them.
Yeah.
Every single day.
And that daily resistance brings us to this concept of livity. I love that Edmonds focuses on this because it shows their faith is never abstract. It's totally embodied.
Livity is the path of righteousness.
Wow.
It means your faith is a lived reality where every choice is a spiritual act. And you see this in two key practices. First, dreadlocks.
Which most people just see as a hairstyle.
But there's so much more. They're a symbol of the biblical Nazirite vow, a rejection of Babylon's beauty standards, and a connection to the Lion of Judah. It's a very conscious severing of ties with colonial norms.
And the second big practice is the idol diet,
which is all about natural, pure food, often vegetarian or vegan, avoiding processed foods, and crucially, avoiding salt.
Why is salt so important to avoid?
Well, it's not just about modern health ideas. It's about purity. Processed foods, things with added salt, are seen as part of Babylon's corrupt, industrialized system. Idol, from the word vital, is about sustaining the body, the temple of Jah, only with what the earth naturally provides.
Your dinner plate becomes a form of resistance.
Exactly. And this extends to their communal practices, like the use of ganja.
Which Edmonds is very careful to explain.
Yes. It is strictly a holy sacrament. It's not for recreation. It's used in their communal reasoning sessions to facilitate spiritual insight and meditation. It's a tool to get clarity.
And their use of language, like I and I. That's also part of it, right? To emphasize the divine within everyone and the unity of the community.
Absolutely. Now, what Edmonds also does brilliantly is show that Rastafari isn't monolithic. He breaks down the internal diversity, the different mansions.
This is so important to understand. You have the Nyabingi order, which is the oldest, very traditional, focused on drumming and chanting.
And staunchly anti-political. For them, it's about spiritual liberation first.
Then there's the Bobo Ashanti. They're known for being very strict, wearing turbans, and they have a unique Trinitarian belief.
A very significant theological split. They see divinity in Haile Selassie, but also Marcus Garvey and another leader, Prince Emmanuel Charles Edwards.
And the third major branch is the 12 tribes of Israel, which is often seen as more liberal, more inclusive.
And that adaptability is the hallmark of any successful global religion. But the vehicle that took it global was, of course,
reggae music.
And specifically, Bob Marley. His music was basically public theology. It carried the message of Babylon, Jah, and liberation to every corner of the planet.
But this leads to what Edmonds calls the paradox of globalization.
Right. Reggae gave them a global voice. But how do you keep a sacred, radical message authentic when its symbols, the hair, the colors, the music, get commercialized and sold back to Babylon?
Often stripped of all their original meaning, that's a huge challenge.
It is. It's a tension at the heart of the movement today.
So let's try to synthesize a few core takeaways from all this. The first, and maybe the most important, is that Rastafari is a theology of resistance.
It's not just a set of beliefs. It's a carefully built counter-narrative designed to dismantle mental slavery.
It's an intellectual framework where the oppressed become the chosen people.
Which flows directly into the second theme. The reclamation of African identity. Every single practice is about reversing the psychological damage of slavery and restoring the idea that the black body is divine.
And third, that paradox of globalization we just talked about. The challenge of staying authentic while becoming universally popular.
Mm. And there's a personal application of this for you, the listener. Edmund's focus on livity is really a challenge to all of us.
To look at our own lives.
To examine the consistency between what we say we believe and what we actually do every day.
Yeah.
Are your ethics just theoretical, or are they part of your diet, your choices, your lifestyle?
That's a powerful question. The book is just filled with these kinds of foundational insights. Let me share a few of the core ideas that really stuck with me. First, about its origins. That the movement is the logical and creative culmination of resistance.
I love that phrase. It just debunks the whole idea that it was some kind of, you know, haphazard cult. It shows it was a rational, thoughtful progression.
Right. And the second one, which just nails the theological revolution, is that deifying an African monarch was the ultimate act of theological rebellion.
Because it was a direct repudiation of the white Christ image. It's an affirmation that divinity doesn't only come in a European form. It's so revolutionary.
And finally, on practice. For the Rasta, Livedi ensures that faith is not a Sunday affair, but an all-encompassing reality.
And that explains why the disciplines are non-negotiable. They are the faith in action, 247.
So how can we apply some of these big ideas? First, there's the power of narrative.
Yeah, Rastafari is a masterclass in how marginalized communities can build resilience by reinterpreting dominant stories like the Bible to put themselves at the center of salvation.
It helps you see how any group builds its identity against a dominant power.
Second, the principle of holistic living. We can take that idea of Livedi and use it to consciously integrate our own beliefs with our daily choices, whether that's about food or ethical consumerism.
And third, it teaches us critical hermeneutics.
Basically, a fancy way of saying we should learn to approach any powerful text, religious, political, whatever, with a critical mind.
Understanding that its meaning can completely change depending on who is reading it.
The powerful versus the oppressed will read the exact same words and see fundamentally different things.
Such a powerful lesson. And as we wrap up, there's one last surprising insight from the book. How the movement handled the theological crisis of Haile Selassie's death in 1975.
That had to be the ultimate challenge, right?
Okay.
If your central belief is in his physical divinity, what happens when he dies?
But the movement didn't collapse. Edmund shows how resilient they were. Some believers argued he just withdrew his physical form. Others adapted, focusing on his eternal spiritual essence.
That flexibility, that adaptability, that's really the final takeaway here.
It is. Rastafari is just this incredible testament to the creative power of the human spirit to forge meaning and hope out of trauma. It's a movement that demands serious study.
And Edmund's book is the definitive guide. It really gets you to the revolutionary heart of it all.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.